The Institute on Religious Life presents these lectures on Catholic doctrine by Father John A. Hardin of the Society of Jesus to give impetus to the new evangelization called for by Pope John Paul II. This series on Understanding the Bible, Part 8, was given during the fall semester 1993 at Domino's Farms, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Remember, we are looking at Scripture in our present class, and specifically the teaching of the Scriptures on the evil spirit. Let me read out loud the quotation from St. Peter. We may say the first papal encyclical, except this one, was not only written by the first pope, but also inspired by the Holy Spirit. It is the clearest and most precise directive on how we are to deal with the evil spirit. And we read, all of you practice humility towards one another, for God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in the time of visitation. Cast all your anxiety upon him, because he cares for you. Now, St. Peter was inspired to say that first, before he began talking about the devil. Why was that introduction important? Because if there is one precondition for coping with the devil, it is humility. Every proud person is an agent of the devil. And the deeper the pride, the more that person is under the influence of the evil spirit. And now, St. Peter's directive for coping with the devil. Be calm, be vigilant, because your enemy, the devil, he is prowling round like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same suffering befalls your brethren all over the world. With that as a backlog, the explanation, and then something of the teaching of the saints. I can assure you, this one page is very important for the spiritual life. Number one, the basic need for overcoming the devil is humility. As we've just said, proud people are no match for the evil spirit. But remember, the devil is also a liar. And those who the devil uses as his agents will also, like him, be able to mask their pride. Not everybody who talks humbly looks humble, appears to be humble. Not everybody who, keeps looking down is necessarily humble. Humility is in the spirit. And the only reason The only reason we bend the knee is to symbolize bending of our wills, bending of our wills to the will of God. Number two, this first means humble, being humble in our dealing with other people. Now this needs to be said and highlighted. God puts other people into our lives in order to, first of all, enable us to be humble. We human beings cannot become humble unless we are humiliated. And this is one of the graces. One of the graces that God puts into our lives, where He uses other people to humiliate us. And the more tendency we have to pride, the more we need others to humble, or better, humiliate us. However, it is not only that we will not acquire humility without humiliation. We are all naturally proud, every one of us. That is the first description of our fallen human nature. Our fallen human nature is a proud human nature. We must be humiliated. But secondly, God uses other people not only to give us humility, but to enable us to grow in humility. And the more sublime the heights to which God is calling us, the more, I've heard this before, but I didn't realize it, now I know it, the more God will put people into our lives who will humiliate us. If there is no humility without humiliation, there is no sanctity without deep, profound humility. And the proportion remains. In other words, we shall become only as humble as, with God's grace, we have allowed people to humiliate us, and we have profited by the humiliation. Meaning what? Meaning that we grow in humility. Every saint has been deeply humiliated. We need people to humiliate us. Number three, it secondly means humble resignation to God's will, and that means no matter how demanding this can be. The deepest humility is not what other people think of us, no matter how low an estimate others may have of us. That's humility, all right. Well, that's the lowest grade of humility. What's the second grade of humility? Where not only other people think little of us, but we ourselves think little of us. A humble person is humble in his own eyes. And that's the main reason why God has allowed us to sin. And the more gifted a person is, I've learned a lot. My now almost 50 years in the priesthood, 40 years, 46 to be exact. The more gifted a person, the more naturally proud. That's an infallible statement. The more gifted a person, the more naturally proud. Why not? I must have said it to you maybe 20 times. Good for my humility to repeat it. Call in by my novice master. Ask me, you know, what's wrong with you? Everybody's got failings. So I said, you tell me. He did. You are an intellectual bully. I need to be told that. When I get a letter, especially from a stranger, the first thing I notice is the spelling mistakes. The more gifted a person is, the more naturally proud. And that's why some of the greatest saints and apostles of history have been the greatest sinners. To mention just two, Saul and Augustine. Both very gifted. But to be humble in their own eyes, to make sure God made fools of them, so they could look into their own souls and say, I digged in the homily, you idiot, and mean it. But the highest level of humility is not what others think of us, not what we think of ourselves, but what God thinks of us. And His estimate of our humility is in exact proportion to our submitting our wills to His. As I said during the homily, this is our cross. There's only one cross in life, submitting our stubborn wills to the will of God. That's why, as I keep telling people, cross is not first a noun. It is first a verb. Where the will of God crosses our wills. And the divine mathematician makes sure it will be a 90-degree angle. The very opposite of what we want, He will send. And the last thing we want to lose, He will take away. So a humble resignation to God's will, no matter how demanding this can be. Number four, it further means, that's what we are commenting on St. Peter's letter, in which he tells us how to cope with the evil spirit. It means the habit of humble prayer by sharing our wills in patience before the power of God. As we've said more than once, just as there cannot be humility without people humiliating us, so there cannot be patience without pain. We must have suffering. Otherwise, patience is just a speculative virtue. All patient people have suffered. And the more patient they are, the more they must have suffered. And as our faith tells us, we are most like Christ when we share with Him and join Him in His own experience of pain. When I say this, depending on the audience, to people, I've said this more than once, the greatest joy on earth is suffering for the one we love. And the one we should most love is the God who became man in order to show His love for us by suffering. What a privilege. What a blessing. And I mean it. It's real. It does not remove the suffering. But don't you ever dare say that suffering is something you couldn't enjoy. That's a theological contradiction. Then, still commenting on Peter, calmness of spirit is crucial. Peace of soul is a strong shield against the devil. Again, having told you to memorize the sentence which begins, the capacity of the human mind to forget is? Thanks for remembering that. So I keep repeating to hope that somebody will remember something. Remember what peace is. Peace is the tranquility of order. Or negatively, peace is the absence of conflict. Now there are two faculties that we all have in which we need, oh how we need peace. Generically called peace of soul. We need peace of mind and peace of heart. That we have order in the mind and order in the will. And if we have, then there will be tranquility. Tranquility of the mind, tranquility in the will. What is tranquility of the mind? Well, it's peace of mind. And please, years after the Lord calls me into eternity, don't forget, peace of mind is the experience of possessing the truth. Peace of mind is the experience of knowing the truth. That's why, as I keep repeating, and I've checked the medical journals to be able to quote the figures, over 60 million Americans are taking subscription or prescription drugs for tranquility. Tranquilizers. And the medical books are filled with all kinds of tranquilizers. And why? Because America is starving for the truth. There can be no peace of mind unless the mind possesses the truth. And our minds are only as peaceful as they possess the truth. People sometimes ask me, how do you approach people who are, say, Christians but not Catholics? How do you sell them the Catholic religion? Well, 1,000 ads for publicizing Catholicism. But for me, one of the most important is the Catholic faith gives peace, peace of mind. In other words, Your mind is at rest, as it should be, because you got the truth. And then you can pass judgment on all kinds of ideas. You can read a book or the newspaper if you waste your time reading newspapers. I thought I'd get that in. And be able to know, well, this part of the sentence is true, the last part is untrue. When I took my Protestant Churches of America out of print, my first book, all kinds of complaints to the publisher, especially from Protestant seminaries, we need that hardened book to know what we Protestants are. We Catholics know the truth about Protestantism. I can prove it. Having taught for some 25 years in Protestant seminaries, they just love the truth. Oh, you don't open the class by saying, "Now, my heretics." You're nice to them, you're kind, you're gentle. But the poor dears, you know, they're starving. Am I making sense? You're providing them the only food that can feed the human mind, which is truth. But then this peace of soul is not only peace of mind, it's also peace of heart. And this is tranquility, as we said, in the will. The will, is quiet. And what's the condition? Or better, what's the definition of peace of heart? If peace of mind is the experience of knowing the truth, peace of heart is the experience of doing God's will. The idiocy, I've coined a word, the idiocy of thinking that joy comes from choosing to do one's own will. I use that word again. That's idiocy. All the talk about choice is the language of the devil. Honest. And I know what I am saying. Honest to God. The deepest lie that any human being can be a victim of is to think that there is joy, true joy, in choosing to do one's own will. That's how the devil, remember, became the devil. Choosing one's own will is not only demonic in imitating the devil, it's the surest way of becoming a devil here on earth. And there are some devils in high places in our country. I hope I'm still clear. I'm using theological language, but I want to be sure that what we are saying, which is the teaching of the church, is understood. It is in doing the will of God that gives us that peace of heart, which then St. Peter warns us, be calm. Don't allow the devil to deceive you. And the most fundamental deception of the devil is the one I've just described. The deception which makes people believe, now of course there's satisfaction in doing one's own will, But whoever setteth self-satisfaction is true joy. And there are people, I'm afraid, who can go through life and have experienced very little true joy or true peace of heart in their lives. And go on. The line that I do remember is now where St. Peter gets very specific. Be watchful. Vigilance is necessary. The devil is deceptive. Well, there are two kinds of vigilance. There, you might say, bodily vigilance. Guards, say, in a prison. Or, do they call them guards in a supermarket? Are they guards?
Security guards.
Security guards? Lewis, they call security guards? However, the deepest watchfulness is of the mind. And the mind is constantly on the lookout. In other words, our faith tells us the devil is always prowling about, trying to rob us. Rob us of what? Rob us of the only true joy that God has in store for those who are doing His will. We've got to be therefore watchful, vigilant, to recognize the devil's deceit, and that is the main reason for this class. Locked up in the word how. How to overcome the devil. The first elementary condition for overcoming the devil is to recognize the devil when you see him. And the devil, believe me, the devil teaches through the printed word. The devil communicates through the media. Did you know that? The devil speaks through human beings. Did you know that? And it wouldn't be the devil if either that which is printed, or that which is viewed, or that which is heard, or that which is seen, is not attractive. The devil never displays his horns. Pardon me for saying this, but the devil is the most perfumed creature in the world. So I think I told you how rare and expensive perfume in New York City began. Is it still on sale? Called My Sin?
Yes.
Is it still on the market?
Yes.
It must be selling. My Sin. Sometime I would like to publish the Devil's Dictionary. I mean it. And the more you read, the more you read of these seducers. Seducers of the mind and seducers of the human will. And you read their vocabulary. The whole vocabulary of the abortionists is the vocabulary of the devil. Am I making sense? Nothing is called by its right name. The murderers are pro-choice. No human being could have invented that. Consequently, when St. Peter tells us to be watchful, this means first and fundamentally watchful with our minds, to recognize that the devil is here active. Because by the time we are seduced by, let's say, the fragrance of the evil spirit, of course, it must be made in Paris. Where else? By that time, it may be too late. Once we have become bewitched by the evil spirit, to recognize that the devil is active, that's in the mind. But number seven, never be afraid of the devil. So the first law of overcoming the devil is vigilance in the mind, expecting him to be active. And the more faithfully you want to serve Christ, let me tell you, this is absolute truth. The more faithful you want to be to Christ, the more the devil will be after you. And use people to tempt you. Nice people, sweet people. Oh, attractive people. Smart people. Kind, gentle people. Without identifying him with the outstanding heretics in our century. We spent some time together in Chicago. In his free time, well, I suspected, he made sure that somebody was around. He would be walking around saying the rosary. Can heretics be pious? I know of a single great heretic in history who was not externally pious, including Luther. So, vision with the mind. And then, once you recognize him, don't be afraid. However, says Peter, your strength comes from your faith. We cannot even recognize the devil without faith. Recognize the devil without faith. We don't even believe there was a devil. As I was recently told in one parish, where the people were told publicly, all this talk about the devil, that is pious mythology. Oh, how the devil smacks his demonic lips. What are the four aspects of our faith which give us strength to overcome the evil spirit? First, faith in God's presence. We've heard this by now 1,000 times. We believe it. But we've got to act on the realization. Because every temptation, what is it except a manifestation of the devil's presence? But we believe that God is also present. Indeed, God allows the devil to be present in order not to lead us into sin. is not God's intention, but to test and prove our loyalty to God. There is nothing more necessary for overcoming the devil than living in the presence of God. And that's not a figure of speech. When you're in somebody's presence, well, necessarily you do one of two or both things. You listen to what that person is saying, and you talk to the person who is allegedly present to you. So living in the presence of God means listening to God. He's always talking to us, and we always speaking to Him. Always, always. Hope you hear this again. The first words we should utter the moment we awaken in the morning, the first words we say should be a prayer. By the way, we are meeting, in case you don't know, we're having classes next Sunday and the Sunday after. And would you mind if I ask for raising of hands? Not now. I'll give you a week to work on it. But next week I will ask, how many of you during the past week, starting tomorrow morning, had your first words when you got up in the morning were a prayer? So living in the presence of God, speaking to God and listening to Him. How does our faith enable us to cope with the devil? By our faith in His grace. Nothing, we've said this, I cannot count how many times, nothing in our life ever happens. Nothing, nothing. Everything is part of God's providence. So what is providence? It is God providing His grace. In every situation, there are no mishaps, no mistakes. There are no tragedies. We can use those words because we need a human vocabulary. But in the dictionary of God, those are acts of divine providence. And He always gives us the grace we need to benefit from whatever the circumstance into which God places us. The grace to see God behind what happens, and the grace in our wills to cope with, bear with. He wants us to enjoy, and thank God. But remember, the only grace we are first guaranteed is what? The grace to pray for the grace to recognize whatever is in our lives is from God, and that God wants us to draw closer to Him and to prove our love by everything, and I mean everything, that we casually and mistakenly say happens in our lives. Then we must have faith in the power of prayer. Don't be mistaken. Prayer is not a luxury. Prayer is not an additive. Prayer is not an option. If we're going to cope with the evil spirit, we must pray. And the state of grace is not enough to cope with the devil. Because, as you know, there is one ambition the devil has, the most fundamental ambition of the evil spirit, is to rob those who are in the state of grace of the friendship of God. In other words, our faith tells us we must pray. And I keep repeating, because I've seen too many pillars of the firmament totter. I've taught too many Jesuits who have left the priesthood. One was just buried. About 2 weeks ago, my former student, I pray for them, but I also know how active the devil is and concentrating on bishops, priests, and religious, the main target of the devil. And dear Lord, the devil is remarkably effective these days. We must pray. I've said this, I'm sure, more than once to you. Among the letters of Martin Luther to her sister was one in which he told her, "I am so busy I don't have time to see my office." No wonder. No wonder he went haywire. No wonder. You've got to pray. And pray a lot. An awful lot. This is not a pious exhortation. This is the bread and butter of the supernatural life. Again, finally, our strength comes from faith in the realization of our kinship with other people. This is St. Peter. Never think that somehow you, or let's say a chosen soul, oh, how much I am tempted. The trials and problems I've got. My friend, sit down, let me tell you a few things. And most people who come from me for counsel, often strangers whom I will never meet this side of eternity, a strange voice. I can always recognize a part of the country from the accent, New England or the South. I tell them, after they tell me their story of woe, I can multiply whatever you tell me, depending on the person, by 3 or by 5. That's what St. Peter is telling us. We should be strengthened by the realization that our fellow Christians are also being tempted by the devil. And the strength which comes from associating with and encouraging those who are being tempted by the evil spirit.